Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Lamentations chapter 5, which I will entitle Restore Us to Yourself, O Lord. This is the fifth and five poems about the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon in 586 BC, written by the prophet Jeremiah. We begin in Lamentations 5, 1 through 4 with a little bit of introduction. The chapter 5 consists of 22 verses that matches the number of letters in the Hebrew alphabet. However, chapter 5 is not like the first four chapters. It is not an acrostic, each verse beginning with the corresponding letter in the Hebrew alphabet. The first four chapters were acrostics. Chapter 3 had three verses for each letter for a total of 66. Minor detail here. So we start now in verses 1 through 4. Jeremiah begins, "Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our reproach. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our houses to aliens. We have become orphans without a father. Our mothers are like widows. We have to pay for our drinking water. Our wood comes to us at a price." So they've lost their inheritance, they've lost their houses, they've lost their mothers, they've lost their fathers. The mothers have lost their husbands. Bad business. That's what happens after a siege. In verse 4, we have to pay for our drinking water. John Gill says, "They who in their own land, which was a land of brooks of water, of fountains and depths, had wells of water of their own, and water freely and in abundance, now were obliged to pay for it." In other words, the Babylonian captors probably made the people in Jerusalem pay for their water. They taxed it. Also, the wood was taxed also. "Our wood comes to us at a price," Jeremiah says, so the wood was probably taxed also. Before they could bring the wood out of the woods for free. We go now to Lamentations 5, verses 5 through 7. "Our pursuers are at our necks," Jeremiah continues. "We are worn out. There is no rest for us. We have submitted to Egypt and Assyria to get enough bread. Our fathers sinned and are no more. It is we who have borne their iniquities." There's no rest for the Jews, not even on the Sabbath day. They're worn out. Our pursuers are at our necks. They've chased them. The way we would say it is they've got their hands around our throat. "We have submitted to Egypt and Assyria." Now, Assyria, we need to be careful here. Assyria refers to Babylonians who occupied the former Assyrian Empire. In other words, it's the area of Assyria, the land of Assyria, not the political entity, because Assyria had already been wiped out, 609 in Haran, by the Babylonians. We are now in 586. Jeremiah is using the old term for the political power there in present-day Iraq and Mesopotamia. As the Cambridge commentator says, quote, "As the traditional foes of Israel, their name survives in this passage, the Assyrian name, although their empire had been succeeded by that of Babylon." And Ellicott says, "Assyria, as in Jeremiah 2:18, Ezra 6:22, stands for Babylon. Assyria stands for Babylon." All right, so the Jews now have got to submit to Egypt and Assyria to get enough bread. What does it mean to submit to? Benson gives two options. They have to beg for food from Egypt and Assyria, or they have to buy food from Egypt and Babylon, Assyria, Babylon. Calvin says that he prefers begging for food. Well, I don't know. I've never heard of people begging for food from a country and the country saying, "Sure, we'll give it to you." No, I think they have to buy it. The land has been so devastated they can't grow their food anymore. Here's what John Gill says concerning Egypt. The stretching out of the hands or submitting to, as the NASB has it. John Gill says, "Either by way of supplication to beg bread of them, of the Egyptians, or by way of covenant and agreement, or to testify subjection to them in order to be supplied with food." I disagree with Calvin. I don't think it's begging for food. They're trying to make contracts for food because they can't grow enough themselves anymore. Now, submitting to Egypt by the Jews could refer to the fact that many Jews went into Egypt upon the fall of Babylon. We read in Jeremiah 43, verses 5 through 7. "But Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the commanders of the forces took the entire remnant of Judah, who had returned from all the nations to which they had been driven away, in order to reside in the land of Judah. The men, the women, the children, the king's daughters, and every person that Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, had left with Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, and grandson of Shaphan, together with Jeremiah the prophet and Baruch, the son of Neriah. And they entered the land of Egypt, for they did not obey the voice of the Lord. That would make a lot of sense as to when the Jews submitted to Egypt, except it says we have submitted to Egypt and Babylon, Assyria. So it sounds like that it's referring to something more than just the remnant of the Jews going down to Egypt after 586. Jeremiah could have been saying we have submitted to Egypt in the sense of we have become a subordinate ally of Egypt and we submitted to Babylon by surrendering to them in order that we might survive. The problem with that is they didn't really surrender to Babylon. They got whacked before they did surrender. At any rate, the Jews are lacking in bread. They're halfway starving. Verse 7, our fathers sinned and are no more, Jeremiah says. It is we who have borne their iniquities. Now, when you read that verse, it sounds like the current Jews, the 586 Jews, that they are blaming their fathers for what happened. Our fathers sinned, and they're not around. They are no more. They're not around to experience the punishment that we are experiencing. We have borne the father's sins. That's what it sounds like, but that's not what it means. The Israelites were not complaining that they were being punished for their father's sins. As John Gill says, not said by way of complaint, much less as charging God with injustice and punishing them for their father's sins, or to excuse theirs, for they were ready to own that they had consented to them and were guilty of the same. In other words, it's just understood that the Jews realized that the reason they were being punished was for their sins. The children sinned just like the father sinned. The punishment just happened to land on the children. We turn now to Lamentations 5, verses 8 through 10. Jeremiah continues, slaves rule over us. There is no one to deliver us from their hand. We get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the wilderness. Our skin has become as hot as an oven because of the burning heat of famine. Slaves rule over the Jews. Now, who are these slaves? Believe it or not, I have got 9 possible options as to who those slaves that are ruling over the Jews are. So let's go through them. Option number 1, the slaves were those who had been formerly tributary to the Jews, like the Edomites, the Ammonites. They ended up ruling Judah because the Edomites were allied with the Babylonians who came in 586, and they were called slaves because the Babylonians ruled over them. So slaves rule over us. Slaves to the Babylonians like the Edomites rule over us now. Option number 1. Option number 2. The slaves that ruled over the Jews were those slaves who were slaves of those who had been tributary to the Jews. In other words, the Edomites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, they had slaves. And now, because the Edomites, the Ammonites, and the Moabites were allied with the Babylonians, those slaves are now ruling over the Jews. Option number 3. The slaves refer to Babylonian soldiers. This is Adam Clark's view. Colin Delitzsch denies this. In the Babylonian army, they were like slaves. I don't like that option too much. That doesn't ring a bell with me. We go to option number 4. The slaves that are ruling over the Jews now are Babylonian governors. Colin Delitzsch denies this. Ellicott says, yes, it's Babylonian governors. The Chaldeans, it would seem, added insult to injury, sending as rulers those who had filled menial offices in the courts of their kings. So they're slaves to the Babylonian central power, and these menials, these menial officials, come to the land of Judah in order to rule the Jews. That's option number 4. Option number 5. The slaves who are now ruling the Jews are Babylonian slaves who were employed as overseers on the captivity march. The Babylonians hired their own slaves to look out for the Jews as they carried them off from Judah to Babylon. John Calvin denies this option. That's option number 5. Option number 6. This is an option suggested by Matthew Poole. The slaves who ruled the Hebrews were Babylonian slaves serving those Babylonians who ruled the Jews in Babylon, not Judah, but in Babylon. The Babylonians in Babylon were the political masters of the Jews, and they had slaves, and those slaves were telling the Jews what to do. Option number 6, the slaves who were ruling the Jews were Babylonian slaves of the conquering Babylonians in Judah, not in Babylon, but in Judah. Option number 8, the slaves who are ruling the Jews now are Jewish slaves who used to be slaves, but then when they were freed by the siege and the Babylonian invasion, now they have become free, and now their former masters are so destitute they have to subject themselves to slavery to their former slaves. Option number 8, slaves rule over us, Jeremiah is referring to the Babylonians themselves. Jeremiah calls the Babylonians slaves. Colin Delitzsch affirms that this is the true answer. They give a reason in Latin, which I could not understand. But also Ellicott holds to this. He says the Babylonians in general might be called slaves by comparison with the kingdom of priests and the sons of Jehovah. The Jews were a kingdom of priests and the Jews were sons of Jehovah, but the Babylonians were slaves. I don't think Jeremiah is going to be dumping on the Babylonians at this time. Maybe he is. I'm not going to take a stand on that one. That's over my pay grade. Lots of options to choose from. But at any rate, the Jews are now being ruled by slaves. There's no one to deliver us from their hand, Jeremiah says in verse 8. Verse 9, we get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the wilderness. If they leave the city, at least during the siege, before the city fell, they would be whacked by the Babylonian armies. However, I tend to think this is referring to a time after the siege. The rest of the chapter seems to refer to a post-586 setting. There's probably anarchy out there in the wilderness, robbers with swords, and they'll whack you if you go out there to try to gather some grain or olives or something. Jeremiah says in verse 10 that our skin has become as hot as an oven because of the burning heat of famine. Well, this is a metaphor. One's skin becomes hot under the sun or under the scorching east wind that comes off the desert. But now your skin is hot because of famine. As Gill and Clark say, famine is compared to the burning winds of the east. Hunger dries up the pores so that the skin becomes like as if it were scorched by the sun. Now, I'm not familiar with the physiological effects of famine. I'm just quoting one of my commentators on this. Here's some relevant scriptures. Job 30:30. Job says, my skin blackens and flakes off, and my bones burn with fever. Psalms 119:83 says, though I have become like a wineskin dried by smoke, I do not forget your statutes. So apparently, hunger is associated with dry, blackened, flaking skin. We go now to Lamentations 5:11-13. Jeremiah continues, they ravished the women in Zion, the virgins in the cities of Judah. Princes were hung by their hands. Elders were not respected. Young men worked at the grinding mill, and youths stumbled under loads of wood. Verse 11, the women in Jerusalem got ravished. I'm assuming Zion is Jerusalem there. They were raped by the common soldiers of Babylon at the siege. That always happens in sieges. Women are raped. Soldiers are filled with bloodlust. Not only bloodlust, but the other kind of lust. So the women in Zion would include married women, but also the virgins were raped too. Terrible. Verse 12, princes were hung by their hands. Now, these princes were either hung by those who used to be their slaves, they could have hung themselves up to commit suicide, or they could have been hung by the Babylonians as punishment. It's not really clear, but it's a terrible, terrible punishment to be hung by your hands. Elders were not respected. That's kind of an understatement compared to raping and hanging. Verse 13, young men worked at the grinding mill. Notice the contrast between elders and young men, the typical Hebrew way of including everybody in a statement. Young men worked at the grinding mill. Persons were sometimes put to work that way for punishment because it was not pleasant to hitch yourself to a harness and pull an upper millstone around a bottom millstone. Oxen did that a lot of times. If people did it, they were punished. Now, one of the rabbis at the time, named Ben Melech, said that Jews were forced to carry millstones to Babylon because there were no millstones in Babylon. I say he was one of the rabbis at the time. I don't know when he lived, but that's just a statement from one of the rabbis. And we see that young men are working at the grinding mill. Youths are also stumbling under loads of wood. These are typically the jobs of slaves, and instead now the young men of Judah are doing slave work. Now going back to the princes who were hung by their hands, Jameson, Foss, and Brown say that this was a piece of wanton cruelty invented by the Babylonians. We go to Lamentations 5:14-16. Elders are gone from the gate, young men from their music. The joy of our hearts has ceased. Our dancing has been turned into mourning. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. I mentioned earlier that the people of Judah realized they had sinned. They weren't trying to blame their father's sins on their current plight. I should have mentioned this verse here to prove that. They admit that they've sinned. Verse 14, elders are gone from the gate. Of course, the gate of a city is where political and judicial matters were discussed and settled. Young men are gone from their music. The young men's harps have been hung up on the willows of Babylon. Psalms 137, verses 1 and 2. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps. So the young men are gone. They took their harps with them on captivity as they went into Babylon. And they sat down and cried instead of playing their harps, because they were remembering with sweet nostalgia their hometown of Jerusalem. Verse 15, the joy of our hearts has ceased, says Jeremiah. Our dancing has been turned into mourning. When did the Jews dance? Well, at religious festivals, also for common diversion. Dancing is always a sign of happiness and joy in every culture. No dancing anymore, not in Jerusalem, not in Judah, nothing but mourning. Verse 16, the crown has fallen from our head. The Jews are no longer kings, but rather a vanquished population. We go down to Lamentations 5, verses 17 through 22, and we will finish this chapter. Because of this, our heart is faint. Because of these things, our eyes are dim, because of Mount Zion, which lies desolate. Foxes prowl in it. You, O Lord, rule forever. Your throne is from generation to generation. Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old. Unless you have utterly rejected us and are exceedingly angry with us. Verse 21 gives us the title of this chapter that I used, Restore Us to You, O Lord. Sort of a key verse after all the doom and gloom. Verse 17, Jeremiah says, because of all these calamities, our eyes are dim. The reason their eyes were dim is because they were almost blinded with their own tears from crying so much. They were crying in verse 18 because of Mount Zion, which lies desolate. Zion, of course, refers in general to either the land of Israel or to the city of Jerusalem or to the Temple Mount. Here it's Mount Zion. So it sounds like it's referring to the particular mountain in Jerusalem, the hill. And of course, Mount Zion could be a synecdoche here for the city of Jerusalem because Jerusalem lies desolate, or it could refer to the temple, which is on Mount Zion, lying desolate. Either way, I tend to think it's talking about the temple. Foxes prowl in it. The King James has jackals. Some kind of animals just wander around because there's no civilization anymore. Everything's been burnt to the ground. Verse 19, you, O Lord, rule forever. Your throne is from generation to generation. God's throne on earth, the temple, was shaken and destroyed, but not God's throne in heaven. His throne lasts forever from generation to generation. Now in verse 20, Jeremiah asks, why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so long? Well, how long were the Jews forsaken? Ultimately, now of course, this forsaking of the Jews, this captivity in Babylon lasted longer than Jeremiah's life, but we know from historical hindsight it lasted 70 years. This is according to Jeremiah's famous prophecy of 70 years. Now, the dates of those 70 years are disputed. The easiest way to take it is the Babylonians became top dog in the ancient Near East after the Battle of Haran in 609, when the remnants of the Assyrian army were wiped out and the Babylonians became undisputed masters of the ancient Near East. And then 70 years later, exactly 70 years later, the Persians beat Babylonia in 539. And so the Babylonians were in charge for 70 years, even though the captivity didn't start until 586. Well, actually, there were earlier captivities in 605 and 597. That is disputed by evangelical scholars. I just like the numbers that work so good, 609 to 539. Now, verse 21, Jeremiah says, restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. Restored how? Option number one, that we may be restored to fellowship with God. Option number two, that we may be restored to the land. Now, Calvin holds this view. And, of course, that prayer was answered after the 70 years were over, sometime around 538. Again, people don't know exactly when the Jews came back. They know that the Persians beat Babylon in 539, and then Cyrus issued a decree sometime after that, and the return happened sometime after the decree, but they don't have exact dates. I always just say 538 the next year after the defeat of 539. So somewhere around 538, the Jews return because of Cyrus the Great's of Persia, his edict allowing them to return. And so that means that Jeremiah's prayer that the Jews may be restored was actually answered sometime after 5:39. Renew our days as of old. Verse 22. Unless you have utterly rejected us and are exceedingly angry with us. Now, we have a translation issue in verse 22. This is the NASB, unless you have utterly rejected us. That translation leaves open the possibility that God may indeed have utterly rejected the Jews. There's a possibility, unless you have utterly rejected us, then we're not going to have our days renewed as of old. We will not be restored with you. That's somewhat pessimistic. Now, let me give you five additional translations which are also pessimistic, even more pessimistic, some of them, four of them. Here's the American Standard Version, Lamentations 5:22. But thou hast utterly rejected us. Thou art very wroth against us. Bible in Basic English. But you have quite given us up. You are full of wrath against us. God's Word. Unless you have completely rejected us and are very angry with us, restore us, unless that's true. That's the same translation, basically, as the NASB. That leaves open the possibility that God has completely rejected the Jews. The God's Word in NASB translation, however, the ASV in the Bible in Basic English translation says, yes, God has utterly rejected the Jews, but thou hast utterly rejected us. No question about it. No one less involved. Here's the King James. But thou hast utterly rejected us. Thou art very wroth against us. That's exactly the same as the American Standard. Here's the New American Bible. For now you have indeed rejected us, and in full measure turned your wrath against us. Well, that's a heck of a way to end a book. Of course, the book is pretty depressing if you're a Jew. Well, it has been suggested that the translation should be a little bit more optimistic. One translation I got from one commentator says, though you have rejected us, renew our days as of old, though you have utterly rejected us. That leaves open a good possibility that God will restore the Jews. Another possible translation is, more optimistic translation is, will you utterly reject us? Not you have rejected us, but will you reject us forever? The Darby translation goes that way, or is it that thou hast utterly rejected us? Wouldest thou be exceeding wroth against us? It's a lot of difference. Punctuation really does affect meaning, and the Hebrew text doesn't have punctuation. Lamentations 5:22 in the Young's Literal Translation. For hast thou utterly rejected us? Thou hast been wroth against us exceedingly? ? Well, the Jews take the more optimistic translations. Even though you have rejected us, you will restore us. Will you utterly reject us? Rhetorical question. No, of course you won't. And so the Jewish rabbis make the book end on a hopeful note. And there's something else they do. They repeat verse 21. I don't know if that means when they're reading it or when they're writing it down. I'm not sure exactly when they repeat it, but they do. And as Gill and Jameson Foss and Brown say, they also do the same thing at the end of Isaiah and Malachi, repeating optimistic verses. So let's read verse 21 twice, as if we were Jews. Restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days of old. Second time. Restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old. Now, in my humble opinion, I don't have a problem with any translation. If you just take it like the majority of translations do, you have rejected us, you are very wroth against us. That's true. God has rejected them in 586, but in the future things can change. So that doesn't worry me too much. And besides, we know from hindsight that the Jews were restored. And when I said restored, by the way, I said it was either physically restored to the land or restored to fellowship with God. I didn't mention the possibility that it could be both restored to the land and restored to God, but at any rate, we know that that restoration did take place. I think that whenever you see judgment of God, you always see hope and mercy right behind it. I haven't actually gone through the whole Bible trying to check that out, but my feeling is, having read enough of the Old Testament, that whenever there's judgment, there's also hope for redemption. There's judgment, there's punishment, but then there is mercy, forgiveness, and reestablishment. So on that optimistic note, we have now finished the sad book of Lamentations. We are now ready to go to our next book in the Old Testament, which will be the book of Ezekiel. I hope you stay tuned as we go into the first chapter of that book in the next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.